Hearty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Thanks for tuning in this evening. Welcome to the sunny side of sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
The sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports.
The sunny side of sports show.
Great show, bro. This is sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Let's kick off in Cairo, where a group of disabled Egyptians is not letting the lack of having lost a leg get in the way of playing football. They formed a team they hope will be a part of a professional soccer league for people with special needs. VOA's Faith Lapidus reports.
Mahmoud Tofik, who lost his leg in a road accident more than 20 years ago, is now captain of Egypt's first amputee football team.
I started bringing the people in, and Coach Yusri, the team coach, called me to start training me on freestyle football. I told him I have another dream of becoming a real-life football player, not just a freestyle footballer who has skills.
25 players from different parts of the country train twice a week on a pitch in Cairo, all sharing the same dream to eventually become Egypt's first recognized professional amputee football team. Coach Yusri Ibrahim imagines a local federation which could regulate a domestic league for the disabled.
We have players from different cities, such as Alexandria and Manufia. In each governorate, we are asking the players to form a team to spread the game. Secondly, we went to the Paralympics Committee, and they were extremely receptive. We are advancing in positive steps to present the project to them, and God willing, we will go to the Minister of Youth and Sports.
The rules for amputee football differ from association football. With 7 leg amputee players on each opposing team, the goalie has to have only one arm. Crutches are not allowed to touch the ball, and there are no offsides or limits to substitutions. But it is still football. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
The Voice of America.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on The Voice of America. We heard from Mahmoud Tofik in Faith Lapidus' report. The 28-year-old Tofik earned some fame last year when a photograph of him jumping on the pitch celebrating Egypt's World Cup qualification went viral. Elsewhere in African football, an inspection team is scheduled to arrive in Cameroon Thursday to assess the country's preparations to host the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations tournament. The 2019 Nations Cup is scheduled to be held in June and July after previous editions were staged in January and February. Past scheduling of the Nations Cup caused disputes with European clubs, which had to release their top African players in the middle of the season. The 2019 Africa Cup of Nations will also feature an expanded field of 24 teams, compared with 16 in the past. The global management consulting firm Roland Berger is the independent assessors for the inspection team. The inspectors will be in Cameroon about 10 days and will visit Yaoundé, Garoua, Bafoussam, Douala, Limbé, and Buea. Last month, Confederation of African Football President Ahmad said, and I quote, "If the host country is unable to organize it, we will find a country that will organize it." The authorities in Cameroon, up to the head of state, have always confirmed to us that they will be ready. More African football news. Guinea has paid tribute to former captain Papa Camara, one of the country's all-time great footballers, who died January 4th in the capital, Conakry, after a long illness. Camara was 66 years old. On Sunday, the government organized a tribute for Camara at the 28th September Stadium in Conakry. Antonio Soare, the president of Guinea's Football Association, remembered Camara in this way, and I quote, "The death is a great loss to Guinean football. Let's thank God because he wanted it this way. May his soul rest in peace." And Soare then continued, "Camara made huge sacrifices for Guinean football, and I have wonderful memories of this outstanding footballer whose death is also a loss to African and world football." And Guinea's football chief added this, "I knew and admired Papa Camara. I saw him playing in the rough terrains and beautiful beaches of Conakry during his playing time. He was the player who had the gift of controlling the ball with his head, chest, and feet. Papa Camara shone and seduced the world in the 1976 Africa Cup of Nations tournament, where Sili Nasional reached the final. Papa Camara also played in 5 African Club Champions Cup finals, the former African Champions League competition. Camara won 3 African titles with the Conakry-based club, Hafia FC, in 1972, 1975, and 1977. After his playing days ended, Papa Camara served as an assistant coach for Guinea's national football team. Here's a posthumous Sunny Side of Sports salute to Papa Camara, one of Guinea's all-time great football players, who died January 4th at the age of 66. Still more African football news. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, says 3 legends on the continent, Noureddine Nebet of Morocco, Adel Chedli of Tunisia, and Robert Kidiaba of the Democratic Republic of Congo, have been appointed special ambassadors for the upcoming African Nations Championship, CHAN 2018, in Morocco. CAF says the trio were named in recognition of their contribution to and impact on the game of football. The 47-year-old Nebet is a fan favorite in his native Morocco. He was born in Casablanca, where he began his 17-year professional career with the club Wydad Casablanca. CAF says Nebet also donned the colors of the Atlas Lions, Morocco's national team, a staggering 115 times. Meanwhile, CAF says Chedli made history in Sudan in 2011 when he became the first and only player to win both the Africa Cup of Nations and CHAN titles. Chedli was a member of Tunisia's victorious 2004 Nations Cup winning squad, and he also lifted the CHAN trophy in 2011 at the age of 35 after Tunisia beat Angola 3-0 in the final. For his part, the 41-year-old Kidiaba won the trophy at the first CHAN tournament in 2009 with the Democratic Republic of Congo. Kidiaba is regarded as one of Africa's best and flashiest goalkeepers, famous for his signature bum dance goal celebration. I've seen Kidiaba doing that bum dance, and it makes me chuckle. As I mentioned during Monday's show, CHAN 2018 kicks off Saturday in Casablanca, where Morocco will host Mauritania in the opening match. Now, the African Nations Championship is for African players competing in their domestic league. So, for example, a Moroccan player is eligible to play for Morocco's national team only if he's playing for a Moroccan club. The 16-nation tournament will continue through February 4th when the final is played in Casablanca. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Just ahead, VOA's Adam Phillips will have part two of his feature on the late boxing great Muhammad Ali. January 17th marks what would have been the 76th birthday of the late boxing great Muhammad Ali, who died in 2016. In this encore Sunny Side of Sports presentation, VOA's Adam Phillips takes us back 51 years to a controversial time in Ali's career.
At the start of 1967, Muhammad Ali was the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world, and at the height of his fame and adulation. Indeed, many boxing fans and celebrity watchers had come to agree with Ali's brash insistence that he really was the greatest.
This is the legend of Muhammad Ali, the most popular fighter there ever will be. Ali fights great. He's got speed and endurance. If you sign to fight him, increase your insurance.
Ali had courted controversy, even condemnation, back in 1964, when following his defeat of heavyweight champion Sonny Liston, he converted to Islam and changed his name from Cassius Clay, what he called his slave name, to Muhammad Ali. But his greatest challenge with the establishment came in April of 1967 when he refused to join the American Armed Forces and go fight in Vietnam. The war was dividing the nation, and many supporters of the war reviled him as unpatriotic, a bum, and far worse for his refusal to serve. Ali was convicted of draft evasion, fined $10,000, and sentenced to 5 years in prison, which he was able to put off while appealing the decision. His passport was confiscated. Even worse for his career, the State Boxing Commission stripped Ali of his crown and revoked his boxing license. But for him, the principle at stake outweighed the glories of the ring. Ali spent the next 3 years appealing his conviction and speaking on college campuses to students who also opposed the Vietnam War and to some students who supported the war. But in 1970, Muhammad Ali found the loophole that would get him back into competition. There was no state boxing bureaucracy in the southern state of Georgia, so Ali challenged Jerry Quarry, a powerful white boxer, to fight him there. New York University historian Jeffrey Sammons says the Ali-Quarry fight packed a powerful symbolic punch. It was the stormy civil rights era, and many blacks and whites saw the contest as a showdown between the races.
Remember, Georgia's governor is Lester Maddox, who is this staunch segregationist, is known for running black people out of his restaurant with a pickaxe. But there was a very powerful black state senator, Leroy Johnson, who told Maddox that this would be in his best interest to allow this fight to happen, and he agreed.
The fight took place in Atlanta, Georgia, on October 26, 1970. Ali trounced Quarry in three rounds.
All over, and rightly so, and not before its time.
The federal court overturned Ali's conviction as arbitrary and unreasonable. Ali was ready to regain his world heavyweight title by fighting Joe Frazier. Smokin' Joe had earned the heavyweight title in elimination bouts after Ali's belt was stripped from him. The Ali-Frazier fight was touted as the fight of the century. It would determine which of those two undefeated champs could claim the belt. True to form, Ali played to reporters by taunting and insulting Frazier. Here's one example among many.
Joe Frazier is so ugly, his face should be donated to the Bureau of Wildlife.
Many thought Ali was angry at Joe Frazier, but that wasn't true in the opinion of Madison Square Garden photographer George Kolinsky. Kolinsky was a trusted friend who snapped photos of the fighter in public and behind the scenes for nearly 50 years. Many of those pictures are now on exhibit at the New York Historical Society.
When he talked about Joe Frazier, what he was really doing is being the showman, the performer, the entertainer, to promote the fight. He said, if I sold tickets, then I did my work.
Prior to the fight, Kalinske shot several roles of Ali and Frazier in Frazier's Philadelphia gym. In a first, Kalinske asked them to put their heads together and to lock eyes in an attitude of barely contained fury. Then came the sparring.
And Joe hits Ali so hard in the stomach that Ali actually went down, and I couldn't believe this, that here I have my own fight going on with them. I start to help Muhammad Ali up, and he's looking at Joe Frazier, and he said, you son of a gun can really punch. And Joe Frazier looks at Ali, and he said, that's the way it's going to be the night of the fight. You're going down.
Indeed, Ali lost the so-called fight of the century marquee matchup in 15 rounds. It was the first defeat of his professional career. Undaunted, he then fought boxing great Ken Norton. Norton broke Ali's jaw, handing the erstwhile greatest a second stinging defeat. Again, Jeffrey Sammons of New York University.
And many people thought that that might be the end of Ali's career. And that's also the allure of Ali, that he's able to come back from the brink, from adversity. And he would beat Ken Norton in a rematch, and Joe Frazier would not give Ali a shot at the championship. And Joe Frazier loses his crown to George Foreman, who was enormous and hulking and just destroyed Joe Frazier in two bouts.
George Foreman, now the heavyweight champion himself, did accept Ali's challenge. Ali was heavily favored to lose. The boxing world readied itself for a colossal contest between the two men. It was set for Kinshasa in the former Zaire, now called the Democratic Republic of Congo. Ali called the contest the Rumble in the Jungle.
I think it was speaking to the historic role that Ali had played in terms of black nationalism, black pride.
Almost from the beginning, the African public favored Muhammad Ali over George Foreman. Sammons explains part of the cause.
George Foreman made the serious mistake of taking a German police dog with him to Zaire. And this dog symbolized oppression and white colonialism. So George Foreman became persona non grata. And there was this famous French chant by kids and others, Ali Bumbaye, Ali kill him.
In private, Ali lacked confidence. He spontaneously came to call on his friend, the photographer George Kalinske, at his office.
And I said, what's going on? He said, well, I'm fighting George Foreman in Zaire. He's too big, he's too strong, he's too fast, he's too young, he's too quick, he's too big. There's no way I can beat him in this fight.
Kalinske says he thought about it for a moment, then came up with a strategy that would become an Ali hallmark.
I said, you know, Muhammad, all your life you've been training for this fight, but you didn't know it. Whenever I saw you working out, which are many, many times working out in a gym with your sparring partner, what you do is you lean against the ropes and you let your sparring partner hit you and hit you and hit you. What you do the night of the fight is the same thing. You lean against the ropes, just let them swing away, and you act like a dope on the ropes, like you're sick, like you're not well. And eventually he's going to tire himself out. Then you knock him out. He said, you mean you want me to be a rope-a-dope? I said, okay, we'll call it rope-a-dope. And that's what happened when he fought George Foreman.
The fight took place in a football stadium under the moon. It was a brutal contest, but Ali sent Foreman to the floor in the eighth round and reclaimed his heavyweight title. As ecstatic fans streamed to the ring, the commentator, David Frost, crowed, "The great man has done it. This is the most joyous scene in the history of boxing." Basking in his victory, Ali was invited to the White House to meet President Gerald Ford, a clear sign of Ali's rehabilitation in official eyes. But there were more challenges to come. Most famously, there would be Ali's epic rematch against Joe Frazier in October 75 in Manila, the Philippines. During the build-up to what became known as the Thriller in Manila, the animosity between the two men was electric.
In a short poem, it says there will be a killer and a thriller and a killer when I get the gorilla in Manila.
From the first bell, the men went at each other with unstoppable, constant, vicious energy. Ali finally won in the 15th round, but Jeffrey Sammons says both men paid a terrible price.
And Ali said about it that it was the closest thing to death that he had ever experienced or could imagine. And of course, we know that Ali had Parkinson's syndrome, which many believe was brought on by the brain trauma that he suffered.
There were more bouts, but George Kolinsky and others could not help but notice that Ali was slurring his speech and that his hands were unsteady.
And I said, "Muhammad Ali, why are you fighting? You're going to hurt yourself. You're already becoming hurt." And he said, in his whisper way, he said, "You know, the ring is my stage, and I'm the most famous person in the world to look at. If I didn't have the ring as my stage, if I stop fighting, everybody else is going to forget who I am. So I have to continue this way."
On more than one occasion, Ali attempted freelance diplomacy. In 1979, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, U.S. President Jimmy Carter called for a worldwide boycott of the 1980 Olympic Games in Moscow.
And he enlists Ali to go to Africa to convince African leaders that they should not participate in the 80 Olympics. The African leaders are, first of all, resentful of the fact that Jimmy Carter would send a boxer to do his bidding.
Sammons adds that many leaders were also bitter that the United States didn't boycott the 1976 Olympics in Montreal as a protest against New Zealand, which played cricket, rugby, and football with South Africa, then living under apartheid.
So they said, "You wouldn't support us on the 76 Olympics in Montreal. We're not going to support you on the 80 Olympics in Moscow."
Ali fought his last fight in 1981, a shell of his former physical self. But as his Parkinson's worsened, he committed himself to humanitarian concerns. He represented UNICEF and the Special Olympics. In 1990, during the run-up to the first Gulf War, Ali successfully negotiated with Saddam Hussein for the release of American hostages. He also fundraised tirelessly for medical research into Parkinson's. Photographer George Kolinsky says Ali was almost universally revered later in life. That's why Ali was asked to light the torch inaugurating the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta, Georgia.
He represented goodness, he represented a champion, and he represented a person that the world loved. And when he held that torch up, shaking from his Parkinson's, people began to love Muhammad Ali more and more and more. It certainly was one of the shining moments of his life. There's no question in the world that he is the greatest of all time.
When Muhammad Ali died, the world lost a man many considered to be the greatest athlete of the 20th century. The world also grieved for a principled, albeit flawed, human being who truly combined the beauty of the butterfly with the sting of the bee. For the Sunny Side of Sports, I'm VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
Thanks, Adam. I really enjoyed your Muhammad Ali feature.
This brash young boxer is something to see, and the heavyweight championship is his destiny. This kid fights great. He's got speed and endurance. But if you sign to fight him, increase your insurance. I am the greatest.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Now let's go to the 1996 Olympic City of Atlanta, where Muhammad Ali lit the torch. It's where the University of Alabama football team rallied to beat the University of Georgia Monday night, 26-23 in overtime, to win the national title. There was an unlikely hero for the Crimson Tide of Alabama, which won its fifth national title in the past nine seasons under head coach Nick Saban. Freshman quarterback Tua Tagovailoa came off the bench to replace ineffective starter Jalen Hurts to begin the second half of the game in Atlanta. Tagovailoa's 41-yard touchdown pass to Devonta Smith in overtime gave Alabama the victory. Tagovailoa straight out of Honolulu, Hawaii. And that wraps up the January 9th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer John Dryden. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the sunny side of sports.
I get it.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The administration of President Donald Trump has placed a focus on women's economic opportunities, empowerment, and entrepreneurship. That's because even though there is no better way to strengthen the economy than to boost women's participation in the workforce, still too often women face barriers to success. One persistent problem is women's lack of access to digital technology, said USAID's Senior Coordinator for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment, Michelle Beckering.
In developing countries, it is estimated that 70% of women-owned small and medium-sized businesses are still denied access to the capital they need. Nearly one in two women are shut off from the internet.
In all of our conversations, we're recognizing that technology is the great equalizer. Technology is offering us an acceleration of impact in areas where change has been taking a very long time, said Ms. Beckering. Unfortunately, even as the world becomes ever more digital, women and girls lag far behind boys and men in access to technology, particularly the internet. If you look right now at the gap around the world, 1.7 billion women in the developing world are still unconnected to the internet. And so if you look at the figures, the Intel Corporation has predicted that if you could even bring 600 million women online, that could add an average of between $13 to $18 billion in GDP to 144 developing countries, said Ms. Beckering. Although this is a common problem globally, the reasons for the digital gender gap vary. A recurrent one is high costs of mobile phones and service. In the developing world, some 200 million fewer women than men own a mobile phone, the most common means of internet access there. USAID is looking at solutions to bring down the costs, such as offering two SIM cards for the price of one and using solar-powered charging stations in off-the-electric grid regions. We are also working with people who live under these conditions who have a lot of great ideas for improvements. USAID, said Senior Coordinator Beckering, is working to break down these barriers to allow women the opportunity to achieve their full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Vungani in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 17:30 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondence reports around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.